States this morning. United States versus Kenneth Price. You're Mr. Richardson? You're a law student, where?
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
Where?
University of Chicago, Your Honor.
Okay, well, welcome aboard.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Julius Richardson. It's my pleasure to be here today representing Mr. Price. If I will, I'd like to focus on the unconstitutional show-up claim raised in Section 2 of our opening brief and Section 1 of our reply brief. The government admits that the police use an improperly suggestive show-up procedure. The government, in trial, used the witness that was tainted by that show-up procedure as the only witness that could place Mr. Price in the bank. This court cannot tolerate defendants such as Mr. Price being convicted on the basis of such tainted testimony. Just prior to a show-up in which my client was shown in handcuffs, surrounded by police officers and squad cars with flashing lights, the police told Ms. Monavong, the key witness in this case, and I quote, "We got the guy who did it. We just want you to take a look at him." The government admits that this is improper. Instead, they claim that the testimony should have been admitted nonetheless because it is reliable. As this occurred in court in Kirby suggested, the more suggestive a show-up is, the more that is required to find it nonetheless reliable. In this case, the suggestiveness is both extreme and explicit, and this court should therefore begin with a presumption that reversal is required given that extremeness. Before this show-up, Ms. Monavong, the bank teller, described the robber as a 5'4".
Well, did they really even need an identification here?
They needed an identification of the robber, Your Honor?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, given what was... I thought the whole point of your argument here was that the evidence had to be suppressed. There was no probable cause, or the Terry stopped the...
That's our first claim, Your Honor.
But given what was found, why did they even need an identification?
Well, I agree, Your Honor. They may or may not have needed an identification, but nonetheless, they did use an identification, and that identification violated their due process. If Your Honor's asking whether...
So it's got to be prejudicial.
Right, whether it is, in effect, harmless as the second prong of the plain error test. We think there is question here as to whether Mr. Price would have been convicted without this testimony. This court established in United States v. Hsu that plain errors are more likely to be reversed. The substantial rights test is a lower bar when the error is a constitutional one, such as in this case. And the Supreme Court in Alano said this court need not be convinced that the defendant, in this case Mr. Price, is actually innocent. Only the substantial rights were affected. In this case, Ms. Monavong was the primary government witness, the only witness who could put Mr. Price in the bank. And we think that it is critical to establishing the link that the described 5'4" Hispanic man who robbed the bank was the same person as the 6-foot-tall African-American man who was arrested. And that was our client, Mr. Price.
Didn't he have the money from the bank robbery on him?
He did have the money. He also had several other items on and around him.
And a gun.
And a gun, yes, Your Honor.
So why was her identification critical, as you said?
Her identification was critical to the jury because it was a live human being. As Justice Brennan said in Watkins, the live human being saying, this is the one.
Yeah.
This
is the guy who did it. She is subject to the brilliant cross-examination of counsel, which shakes her. But even if she's described him as being striped and standing at his hands, your defendant was caught with the money and the gun and everything else.
Yes, Your Honor, that is certainly true.
There are moments after, too.
Yes, sir.
Time expired.
Yes, sir. That is all certainly true, Your Honor. But the fact that he was found with those items on or around him, we do not think is sufficient to find that he would necessarily be convicted without this live testimony saying...
What else? What would the jury have concluded, do you suppose, from a man who was caught immediately after the robbery, with the money taken from the robbery and a gun in his belt.
Well, one alternative, Your Honor, is that those items were found. As the government's own witness, Mr. Wilkinski, testified, the man leaving the bank was seen numerous times dropping bundles of cash and other things.
Uh-huh.
It certainly seems
a defense that was offered in the trial.
In fact, there was very little defense.
There was no defense
offered in the
trial. He didn't testify. Hey, I was just walking down the street and I found the money and the gun. And
the reason he was not able to testify to that effect, Your Honor, was because Ms. Monavong's testimony, tainted as it was, tied him to the bank. Without that testimony.
Well, couldn't he have gotten on the stand and said exactly that Judge Evans just suggested, that I found the money as I was walking along, found the gun, so I picked it up and I
was
carrying it along?
He certainly is not required to testify. He could have taken the stand and said that.
I'm trying to think of an explanation for his having the money, having the gun, being within, if I recall, 1,000 feet of the bank, immediately after it happened, and having been seen by other witnesses leaving the bank. What explanation could you possibly come up with to convince the jury that you weren't the right guy?
Well, as I suggested, Your Honor, one is that money was found. There were significant holes.
Yeah, but I mean, you could do that even if you had been misidentified by somebody with a tainted identification.
But it would be a much more difficult claim to make, and certainly potentially a strategic decision not to try to make that claim, given the difficulty of overcoming Ms. Monavong's testimony that he was wearing the same clothes as that worn by the robber. Given that fact, that precluded him from making the claim that he would have had to make that we're discussing here today, that, in fact, he did not take that money or use that gun in the bank robbery.
Well, wait a minute. Wade and all these lineup cases don't say anything about identification of clothing. It's the face that those cases are concerned.
Yes, Your Honor. Certainly, in this case, the identification of, we think in Wade in those cases, it's not just the face, it's the person as a whole. We think oftentimes a number of those cases don't look specifically at the nose or the eyes, but they identify the person. And certainly in this case, the nose and the cheek structure was hidden by a mask, and therefore very difficult to distinguish and determine whether that was a face that robbed the bank or not. And so it is slightly different, Your Honor, in the fact that it is not an identification of a face, but identification of the person. But we think in this case that the identification of the clothing and the man that was wearing that clothing is sufficiently close to the identification of the facial structure that those cases should apply just the same in this case. Several other facts I think are of critical importance. The government did not attempt to tie the items that were shown on and around Mr. Price to the bank robbery. They could have easily taken hair samples from the mask to determine whether Mr. Price had ever had this mask on. They could have taken fingerprints from the gun to determine whether Mr. Price was the only person who had handled this gun on that day, or whether perhaps a short Hispanic man had also had his fingerprints on that gun. Even at trial, there were significant discrepancies, as I've mentioned before, in height, race, and tattoos that could have led a jury, a rational jury, to find that there was a reasonable doubt. I've reached my rebuttal time, and I'd like to say that, Your Honor.
Okay, fine. Mr. Chan.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Both the show-up argument that has just been raised before you, as well as the Terry stop argument that defendant asserts for the first time before this court, both of those arguments have been waived. And there are three reasons that this court should hold that they are waived in this case. And the government feels very strongly about the waiver argument in this case because
the strength of the government's feeling is really not exciting to me.
Your Honor, the reason I raise it in that context is that the court's jurisprudence in this area leaves open a slight question that this might be a forfeiture, not a waiver. And we think that a proper reading of the text of Rule 12, and particularly Rule 12F, as well as consideration of this court's precedents, as well as the policy reasons that underlie Rule 12 and 12F, strongly indicate that this should be a waiver, and that any notion that this might be a forfeiture, which is raised in the defendant's reply brief, should a clear, bright-line test should be set so that when litigants are facing the deadlines that they're faced under Rule 12b and 12c to raise suppression motions or raise severance motions.
So your motion was in defense of the purity of the law, not the factual situation here.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And 12b requires the motions to be suppressed be raised prior to trial. Rule 12c gives district court judges the right to set deadlines for those motions. Rule 12f states unequivocally that the failure to file a suppression argument waives appellate review of that issue, and this court has so stated many times. Now, 12F also has one very other important additional provision, and that is that a district court, or for that matter this court, may excuse the waiver of a suppression argument not made for good cause shown. And that's an important additional provision because it somewhat mitigates what otherwise might be the harshness of a waiver rule in some circumstances. So the answer to a government claim that a suppression issue not raised prior to trial is waived, the only permissible answer to that argument is that there was good cause. And that has not been asserted before Judge Holderman in the district court. That has not been asserted before Your Honor, that there was any reason not to raise the show-up issue in a motion to suppress prior to trial. They did not move to suppress her testimony in any way. They did not object when she took the witness stand and made certain statements with regard to what she observed. In this case, the defense had its own strategic plan that it was going to use the show-up identification to try to undermine her credibility and undermine the police handling of the matter once they were called in. To now turn around and say her testimony should have been excluded. This is the exact type of sandbagging of district court judges that this court has repeatedly said it would not allow. This is an argument that was never raised before Judge Holderman. He never had any right to review any criticism of the show-up procedure or of Ms. Mooney Vong's testimony. And that's why it should be waived. This court, in a case called Mansillis, in a case called Krenkel, stated unequivocally that under 12b and 12f, failure to file such a suppression motion waives the right to appellate review of the issue. Now, in the most recent case on the subject, a case called Clark, this court had a thoughtful discussion. First of all, at the beginning of Clark, they come right out and say what they say in Mansillis and Krenkel, and they cite Mansillis and Krenkel, and the court says 12f constitutes a waiver. But then the court goes on to say, but not all waivers are waivers. Some waivers might be deemed forfeitures. And the court cites two cases at that point. And the government would submit that those two cases, neither of which had anything to do with 12F, are not a basis to treat these waived claims as forfeiture. In that particular case, Clark, after the dicta that says this might be forfeiture, not waiver, the court in the next section goes on to say, we don't need to resolve that waiver or forfeiture issue in this case, because in this case, the defense counsel specifically told the district judge, I am not pursuing a suppression argument as to anything else but the gun in that particular case. And so the court in Clark says, we don't need to address the waiver forfeiture distinction because we have an intentional relinquishment here. We would submit, Your Honors, that in this case, the court should state unequivocally and establish a bright line that if you do not file prior to trial and articulate your suppression arguments prior to trial by the deadline set by the district court judge, except for good cause asserted to the district court judge, you have waived your right to assert that issue. And there are really two different policy reasons why this is important. It protects the district court. It protects the district court's right to set its deadlines and to control its docket. It's meaningless if the judge says you have to, by Friday, file all of your suppression motions, and then halfway through trial, the defense says, you know, Judge, as the trial's progressing, I've thought of some really good suppression motions, and I'd like to assert them, and the judge says, sorry, you're too late, you missed the deadline, and then the defendant says, well, the Court of Appeals allows me to raise this as plain error review, so therefore, I'd like to make my record right now, because I know the Court of Appeals is going to allow this to be considered. Therefore, even though I missed the deadline, Judge, at a minimum, you got to allow us an offer of proof. It's going to be havoc in the district courts if we don't state clearly that the
deadline. You may be exaggerating the problem in the district court. I doubt whether havoc will run.
Havoc may be too strong of a word, Your Honor. The appellate court also benefits by having a bright line rule. You then are not faced with situations as you are here where you have to face arguments that have either a wholly undeveloped record below or even a partially developed record below.
Well, it keeps the day from being dull, so go ahead.
Well, that's true also. Finally, I would just say...
That's not necessarily true.
I'm trying my hardest on that story. If there is to be relief from a waiver, the relief really has to be through the good cause provision. And so therefore, Your Honor, we request that on both claims, the show-up argument and the Terry argument, that the court conclude that those are waived. Now, in the event that the court disagrees, I would state briefly with respect to the argument that was made. Two points that were made by counsel's argument. One is this is a case where there cannot be plain error because the evidence is overwhelming. The points that were raised in defense counsel's argument are the fact that he was found with the money, the gun, the ski mask 1,000 feet from the bank. This is overwhelming evidence that cannot be overcome. But the other point is that Ms. Munivong's actual testimony was not a corporeal, I believe Your Honor said that that most of the lineup cases are where the person says, I saw the face, and that it's seeing the face, the suggestiveness of seeing the face at the show-up or at the lineup that influences the in-court testimony of seeing the face. That's not what we have here at all. What we have here at all is she saw blue jeans and a blue shirt. She leaves the teller window, she goes to her supervisor, she tells her supervisor, I saw blue jeans and a blue shirt. That's called into the police. Only later is she brought over to the show-up identification and is only asked to identify the clothing. She's not asked to identify the face, nor could she because he was wearing a ski mask. She then identifies the shirt and the blue jeans. Then she's brought into court as a witness, and she only identifies the shirt and the blue jeans. At no point did she point at the defendant and say, that's the person I saw at the bank window. That might be a situation where they could argue there was suggestiveness of a face that she saw at the show-up that perhaps she didn't see clearly at the window.
She wouldn't even get to testify.
Pardon?
She wouldn't even get to testify under the conditions.
That is
to say, she wouldn't be able to point him out. Did you see his face? No, I didn't see his face. Did you see him here in the courtroom? The answer is, who cares?
Correct. Exactly right, Your Honor. And on those bases, Your Honor, we would ask this court to affirm the opinion, verdict, and sentence below. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Richardson, you have 2 minutes.
In response to Your Honor's question of who cares, I think we all should. The constitutional rights of a defendant have been violated here.
No, I said who cares in this case when the evidence, as was pointed out, could have been kicked in with their foot and you wind up with exactly the same thing. There is no answer to it. And I sympathize with your point of view, but she did not identify him in court as a person. She identified only the clothing.
We don't find that the fact that the face was not used in this case to be anywhat distinguishable from the cases in which the face or the build or anything else was any description, we think of the clothing or the face or the cheekbone structure.
The face is what is the concern in all these lineup cases. If the robber has a jacket that says University of Chicago Law School class of 2004 on it.
2003, I think, in this case, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
2003, 2004. You can always say the robber had that jacket on, and the police can say that when we stop X, this is the jacket he was wearing. That's not ever an issue in lineup identification cases. It's the facial features.
We think the suggestiveness in this case applies to the clothing worn. Ms. Monavon was having trouble describing the shirt to the police, and the suggestiveness of the show-up affected her ability to distinguish what clothing was worn by the robber and that by Mr. Price. With regard, I just have a few moments, with regard to the waiver issue, we asked the court to look at this court's decision in United States v. Funches. It's directly on point. A suppression claim was made, but not with regard to an identification procedure. This court reviewed it for plain error. Counsel respectfully requests this court to overrule its precedent, which is just out of line, and the court should just maintain the line it is. Finally, I'd like to close by saying that this is a case where the police were egregiously wrong in showing up Mr. Price. The government admits that. The only question is whether we should allow Mr. Price to be convicted on that ground. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. And Mr. Richardson, thank you for your fine presentation. Thanks to the University of Chicago for participating. That case will be taken under advisement. And